Support a community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Coming up is non-human radio, but we'll go ahead and let Between the Lines finish playing.
Wholesale decline in corporate taxes. And yeah, there's no question that this is a factor in the growing economic inequality, wealth inequality, income inequality that has been widely documented over the last 50, certainly the last 25 years. The reason for that is that economists generally agree that corporate taxes are paid primarily by owners of capital, by the owners of stock. To some extent, it's passed through to wage earners, but that's a pretty small part of the story. On balance, it's a tax on wealth, and wealth is disproportionately held by the top 1%, the top 5% of Americans. When you have a shift in taxation away from profitable corporations toward everyone else, that is unambiguously a shift away from progressive taxes, taxes that fall primarily on the best off, and toward regressive taxes, taxes that hit low middle-income families more heavily.
That was Matthew Gardner, senior fellow with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, and lead author of the group's new study on the first year of the Trump GOP tax cuts. Find a link to download a copy of the report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
All right. Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by OHM Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. OHM Foods serves homemade teas and lemonade, acai bowls and smoothies blended with coconut water, and you can find them at 142 Broadway, just two blocks from Chico State. They're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., with to-go and catering available. For more info, you can find them at iloveohmfoods.com and, of course, on Facebook. And we're made possible by Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. Welcome to show 20-02, the January 8th, 2020 episode of Non-Human Radio, a roundup of current news on animal issues focusing on animal agriculture, animal rights, and veganism. I'm your host, Jeannie Trezino, and I'm here every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. You can listen to streaming and archive shows at kzfr.org. And if you enjoy this program, you can go to kzfr.org and tip this show through a handy link on our webpage. On today's show, we'll be covering a few news stories, leading with a new trend in corporate divestment from the livestock sector. That will be followed by news of proposed legislation by vegan Senator Cory Booker and a piece on the history of milk overproduction in the United States from the activist group Switch for Good. We'll end with some extraordinary good news by a very special, very long-lived wild king eider duck. Our first news piece is an article from the Bloomberg Finance News on a new divestment trend titled, After Taking on Coal and Oil, Climate Investors Target Meat Next. The article starts, investors are starting to give meat suppliers a warning that has already sent ripples through the coal industry. Make better progress tackling climate change or risk being shunned. The threat of divestments in the livestock sector, one of the top contributors to global emissions, is rising as asset managers increase scrutiny on the sustainability and carbon footprint of their holdings. Investors, including legal and general investment management, have already started to divest from some food companies and said they may offload others that don't meet certain environmental requirements. Quote, it's possible that we'll see this type of banning or investors deciding not to invest in livestock companies or meat processors, said Stephanie Susan, a portfolio manager at Amundi Group's CPR Asset Management, which manages more than $55 billion. She went on to say, if you are interested in livestock companies, your CO2 footprint will be too high, end quote. Agriculture-related industries are second only to energy in terms of emissions. Raising animals accounts for about 15% of the global total as cows belch out methane, while grazing and growing soy for animal feed contributes to deforestation. Investors say major issues like animal welfare, the popularity of vegan diets, and less meat consumption in the United States and Europe will reshape the food industry for years to come. And it's an opportunity to make money from betting on the winners and losers. Capitalism in action, folks. The climate movement has already caused big changes in energy. Mining giant Rio Tinto Group has sold its coal operations, and BHP Group is in the process of exiting the fuel, while Nordic money managers are dumping billions in fossil fuel stocks. Asset managers are already taking action against food companies. Legal & General this year said its Future World Fund would divest from SPAM meat maker Hormel Foods Corporation and retailer Kroger Company because they aren't doing enough to address risks associated with climate change. Store brand Asset Management AS plans to sell its shares and bonds in companies by 2025 unless they make progress in mapping out how their supply chains affect deforestation. It has already placed agribusiness giant Cargill Inc. and 12 other companies on its exclusion list because of unsustainable palm oil activities and deforestation risks. The food sector, quote, hasn't been at the forefront of the climate debate, but is one that we expect to become much more prominent, said Catherine Ogden, manager for sustainability and responsible investment at Legal & General, which has more than $1 trillion in assets. Quote, if the sector doesn't move and if land use and agricultural practices don't change, then we're not going to reach the climate goals. Something has to change, end quote. For now, investors are focused on pushing companies to disclose more information. About three-quarters of the meat and dairy industry reveal little or nothing about emissions coming from their operations and supply chain, a study by investor network FAIR showed. Investor action in the meat sector won't be as straightforward as in coal, which has been losing ground to natural gas and renewables. An expanding global population will consume more protein, and substitutes such as faux meat account for just a fraction of the current food market. Quote, we have to have a different perspective when it comes to protein than we have on other issues such as coal, said John Eric Saugestad, chief executive officer of Storebrand, which manages about $750 billion kroner portfolio. That's about $83 billion U.S. dollars. Quote, it's a complex issue. We need protein now, and we will need protein in the future, end quote. And that was an article titled, After Taking on Coal and Oil, Climate Investors Target Meat Next, by Agnieszka D'Souza and Ayn Quinn, published on December 13, 2019, in the Bloomberg Financial News. Definitely not coming from the vegan perspective. This isn't clickbait type news that you see on some of the vegan news sites. This is from Bloomberg, and I would suspect that if you see these kinds of changes happening with these big investment portfolios, that will have a ripple effect through the rest of the marketplace. You're listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Our second news piece is an article on Senator Cory Booker's proposed legislation to limit the growth of industrialized animal agriculture, written by Tom Philpott for the Mother Jones website, posted on December 16, 2019. The article starts out, as his presidential bid struggles to gain traction, Senator Cory Booker is out with a bold new bill, introduced on December 16th, that proposes a serious crackdown on two powerful industries, meat and dairy. It might seem like a strange move for a candidate seeking to increase his broad appeal in a meat-loving nation, especially one who already flouts carnivory by embracing a vegan identity. That's a wordy way to say that Cory Booker is a vegan. Americans rank among the globe's most voracious consumers of chicken, beef, pork, and dairy, and in 2020, U.S. per capita meat production is expected to reach an all-time high. But there's a creeping unease about the way these foods are produced. Most of them come from factory-scale facilities known as CAFOs, that is, a concentrated animal feeding operations, that generate the potent greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, and have been known to pollute water and foul air for surrounding communities. The public's growing discomfort with this system shows up in the booming popularity of alternatives to the animal factory model, from pasture-based meats to high-tech soy burger patties. And it's evident in the way communities in livestock-heavy regions Wisconsin, Iowa, North Carolina, Delaware, Maryland are rebelling by filing lawsuits and demanding that the industry scale back. Generally, state governments in these meat-centric regions side with the industry against these appeals to hold the industry accountable for its environmental messes. The federal government, even under Barack Obama, but more so under Donald Trump, largely does the same. Here's where Booker's bill comes in. It would place an immediate moratorium on new, large-scale CAFOs. The bill would also halt the expansion of existing CAFOs over a certain size. And it would devote $100 billion over the next 10 years to a voluntary buyout program for CAFO owners who want to exit the business. The fund would also offer transition assistance to operators who want to take up, quote, agricultural activities such as raising pasture-based livestock, growing specialty crops, or organic commodity production, end quote. The transition program is important, said Jake Davis, policy director of the Missouri-based group Family Farm Action, a nonprofit that fights corporate control of agriculture and that has worked with Booker's office on farm policy. Large-scale chicken and hog growers tend to work under contract for the tiny handful of transnational companies that dominate the poultry and pork packing markets. The growers take on debt, often in excess of $1 million, to build out, maintain, and regularly upgrade fast barns tailored to company specifications. For their trouble, contract poultry farmers on average are likely to earn about $11.50 an hour after accounting for operating and interest expenses, according to a 2014 USDA study. So much for the family farmer, right? This is a misconception about where meat, where animal products come from, that it's coming from Old McDonald's farm. It's not. It's coming from these subcontractors to big conglomerates. The article goes on, Jake Davis from the Family Farm Action Group told Mother Jones magazine that, quote, most contract growers I talk to, they wish they hadn't gotten into that world to start with. It's a hamster wheel that's not easy to get off of. If you don't keep taking on more debt to upgrade your barns, you don't get more birds or pigs from the companies. And if you stop, you can't pay the note on your farm, end quote. Cory Booker's bill would also bolster the Packers and Stockyards Act, a 1921 law designed to prevent the power imbalances that now exist between packers and farmers, but that has gone largely dormant in recent decades. And it would make the packers responsible for the pollution produced by CAFOs they have helped to finance. Currently, manure pollution is the responsibility of the growers. Even though they're under contract to these other larger companies, it falls on the heavily indebted so-called grower. In general, though, manure pollution is lightly regulated in general. The bill has no chance of advancing in the Republican-controlled Senate, but the ideas in it might just up the ante in the Democratic caucus in Iowa, which takes place on February 3rd. In a survey commissioned in December by Johns Hopkins University's Center for a Livable Future, a majority of Iowans supported the idea of banning construction of new CAFOs and expansion of existing ones, and 80% expressed concerns about the new threat of water and air fouled by huge concentrations of manure. Many leading Democratic candidates have proposed ambitious ag policy reforms, and two in particular, Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren, have called for antitrust action against the meat companies. Among candidates responding to a questionnaire by the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Action Fund, Sanders and Warren joined former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro in expressing support for a CAFO moratorium. Sanders is the only candidate besides Booker to propose a substantial bucket of money to help current livestock growers to get out from under the thumb of the packers. As communities push back against manure pollution and contract farmers scrape by while packers like Tyson generate record profits, there are likely many people in rural America who are going to support policies that help farmers gain independence from corporate control. And that was an article titled, Cory Booker Just Went All In Against Factory Farming and the Meat Industry, published on December 12, 2019 on the MotherJones.com website. Our next news piece is an article about the history of dairy from prehistoric times to the present from the Switch for Good website. That's an advocacy group that is encouraging people to give up cow-based dairy. The article begins, according to the evolutionary history and fossil records, the modern human has inhabited this earth for the past 200,000 years. Historians date the practice of drinking cow's milk back to only the past 8 to 10,000 years. What this should tell us is that consuming the milk of another species isn't instinctual, and our bodies don't naturally crave it. So the question is, which one of our ancestors looked at a cow's udder, licked their lips, and started sucking? Perhaps more importantly, why did others join in? Relative to human existence, the history of milk is considerably short, yet it is truly riveting. Power, corruption, greed, mass manipulation, all are present in the evolution of milk in our modern society. Thanks to the bizarre thinking of that early human, most of us are guzzling down a substance not meant for human consumption. It's time to leave cow's milks to the textbooks and, of course, to baby cows. Fast forward through the evolution of lactase persistence in European regions. Yes, all early humans were lactose intolerant past their toddler stage. Domestication of dairy cows, the invention of cheese making, millions of people who died from milk-borne illnesses prior to the invention of pasteurization. A side note, a fourth of all foodborne illnesses in the United States were attributed to cow's milk prior to the early 1900s. And the invention of the glass milk bottle. We find ourselves in 1922 with the seminal passing of the Kapper-Volstead Act. The bill gave ag industries permission to act together, form organizations, and market their products. While the industry was very much reliant on small farms back in that time, this bill paved the way for the enormous dairy conglomerates and massive milk marketing campaigns of today. Without it, the American people would never have known the phrase, got milk. Before going further, a note on skim milk. Prior to the 1930s, most skim milk was literally sent down the river. Families who drank milk had one option, whole milk. But skim milk still existed as a byproduct of the butter-making process. This so-called waste was commonly disposed of by dumping it into rivers throughout the 1920s until the government was forced to put a stop to it due to the horrific odor of spoiled milk that permeated the surrounding areas. It wasn't until the 1950s that skim milk received some commercial attention, though this was in the form of a dry, powdered, just-add-water mix. The industry also had plenty of skim milk to get rid of, as much of it was left over from World War II, when dry milk powder was used as a relief food. To chisel down this surplus, the industry employed marketers to position skim milk as a weight-loss food. Milk dealers received backing from physicians to peddle this product as a health food, and by the 1950s, skim milk had transformed from a waste byproduct to a trendy weight loss beverage, mostly consumed by affluent society. In reality, farmers just needed a way to get rid of and profit off of the skim milk that they had made during the war effort, which tends to be the theme in milk's history. If you make too much of something, turn to clever marketing to dump it. World War I was a global event that catapulted America's century-long milk surplus into existence. The U.S. government started sending canned and powdered milk to soldiers overseas, and dairy farmers responded by ramping up production. They invested in the latest equipment and even abandoned other forms of farming to dedicate their work to the war effort. When the war ended, the milk production did not, creating a surplus and dangerously low milk prices. Throughout the 1930s, dairy farmers staged several strikes and unionized to demand a fair price for their milk. To appease these farmers, the government created federal programs to artificially drive demand. The first of these programs included the 1940 Federal Milk Program for Schools and federally subsidized milk advertising under the Works Progress Administration, the WPA. In 1946, President Truman passed the National School Lunch Act, which mandated that each lunch include between 1.5 to 2 pints of whole milk. And by the way, two pints is a quart of milk, which is just astounding. Since adults were not buying milk, the government's solution was to force it onto their kids through this program. Even to this day, children who participate in the National School Lunch Program, which offers free or low-cost lunches to students of low-income families, are required to take a carton of dairy milk, even though they're not required to actually drink it. Despite the government-funded campaigns to convince nearly every demographic of America to drink more milk, the surplus continued throughout the decades. In 1977, President Jimmy Carter allowed $2 billion federal dollars to be funneled into the dairy industry over the course of 4 years. As in the past, dairy farmers ramped up production to take advantage of this government subsidy, which resulted in yet a greater surplus. This soon-to-rot milk was homogenized into government cheese, and it was held in vast underground storage units across 35 states. Not only was this a waste, it was also very expensive. In 1982, a New York Times reporter stated that the federal government would spend between $40 and $50 million transporting this surplus dairy and another $40 to $50 million to store it. By this time, the government subsidy was spending $2 billion in taxpayer dollars annually to support the dairy subsidy. The solution was twofold. Give the nearly moldy cheese to low-income citizens and funnel money into heavy dairy marketing. The Dairy Checkoff Program, which is an industry-funded federal marketing program, has had a profound impact on what Americans choose to consume. Prompted by the dairy industry, Congress created a National Dairy Production, Promotion, and Research Board in 1983, whose sole purpose was to promote dairy products by way of marketing and, quote, nutritional education. To fund this effort, dairy farmers agreed to pay a small fee based on the weight of the milk they sold. This program is responsible for some of America's most craveable and least healthy food products, including Pizza Hut's stuffed crust pizza and Taco Bell's quesalupa and its succeeding quesarito. The board has worked with dozens of companies to promote dairy-heavy menu items. The result is 40% more cheese on Domino's pizzas, more milky drinks at Starbucks, and larger cheese slices on Egg McMuffins. In addition to these corporate collaborations, the Checkoff program is also responsible for the pro-dairy slogans that we can never forget. Ever heard of Got Milk or that milk does a body good? The illusion that chocolate milk is a recovery food is also an industry-supported idea. These studies that demonstrated a positive correlation between athletic performance and chocolate milk were funded, at least in part, by the dairy industry and specifically designed to favor dairy. Scientists ensured the industry's desired result by comparing chocolate milk to water or a nutritionally deficient sports drink. Of course, most constituents don't read beyond the fold, let alone analyze scientific studies. People see the professional athlete sporting a milk mustache when they flip the page in a magazine, or they scroll through headlines and see that a new study confirms the benefit of chocolate milk in teen athletes, and they're reminded to add milk to their grocery list. Milk has become so ingrained in our culture that we cannot see past the smoke and mirrors to see what milk really is, a century-long problem the government cannot spend enough money to get rid of, no matter how many cheese pizzas Pizza Hut sells. Looking back, we see that milk is a very heavily funded and well-marketed product. If that ancestor had decided to suckle a dog instead of a cow, we might all be drinking dog milk. Or if there was a mass surplus of soda in the early 1900s and the soda producers barked loudly enough, cola would have been today's pre-workout beverage. We believe milk is healthy because that is what we have been told, and there is little to question this until now. Start asking questions. Why do adults still drink milk? Why do we obtain it from an entirely different species, let alone a being that is not our mother? Why do we continue to guzzle down a drink that leaves us bloated and uncomfortable hours later? It simply does not make sense. And that was from an article titled The Twisted History of Milk in America, published on the Switch for Good website in October of 2019. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. Our final news story is on the amazing news that a duck banded by wildlife rehabbers during an oil spill in Alaska 24 years ago has been recaptured. This bird is the oldest known king eider duck. This is just a little bit of happy news. The article from the International Bird Rescue website begins, "A new bird banding report shows something truly remarkable. The oldest known king eider, a species of sea duck, was a 24-year-old oil spill survivor cared for by International Bird Rescue. This finding proves once again that rehabilitated, formerly oiled birds can survive many years after treatment and release back to the wild. The latest discovery involves a male king eider that was oiled as an adult during an oil spill in Alaska in 1996. The body of the bird was recovered in the area where it had lived, and records show that the bird survived 23 years after oiling and release. According to federal bird banding information, this may well be the oldest known king eider. This important news underscores what International Bird Rescue has been advocating from its beginnings. Oiled birds can and do survive to live normal lives when rehabilitated after oiling with appropriate resources and skilled staff. This is the fourth king eider from the 1996 spill that has been reported through the bird banding lab. Male king eiders are near and dear to my heart. They are known for their very ornate and distinctive plumage, and they are common in Arctic waters of the Bering Sea. That was from an article entitled Oldest Known King Eider Found 23 Years After Oil Spill Care, at the bird-rescue.org website, posted in December 2019. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino. Before we get to the calendar of events, I just wanted to let you know of some organizations you can support. As you no doubt know and are saddened and saddened by, Australia is suffering through an epic round of bushfires. If we in the North State have any experience from wildfires in the last couple of years, we can empathize with what Australians are going through, and in particularly the unique wildlife there. There are a couple of organizations that you can support if you are able, and if not, you can at least share the information perhaps with your friends. New South Wales Wildlife Information Rescue and Education Service, that's WIRES Wildlife Rehab Australia, is Australia's largest wildlife rescue organization. They've been rescuing and caring for wildlife over 30 years and have been heavily involved with the bushfire rescues. You can find them at www.wires.org. Koalas in Care in New South Wales are taking care of koalas, and you can find them at koalasincare.org. There is a koala hospital at Port Macquarie, also in New South Wales, that you can find at www.koalahospital.org.au. And the equivalent of NAVDAG of the North Valley Animal Disaster Group and the California Veterinary Medical Reserve Corps, their equivalent in Australia is the South Australian Veterinary Emergency Management Group. It's a Tier 2 response and recovery agency. You can find and support them at www.saveem.org.au. This group has been critical in helping the wildlife in South Australia's Kangaroo Island, which is an offshore island haven for rare wildlife, basically untouched, undeveloped by people. A third of that island has been burned in the bushfires. So again, that group is SAVEM, S-A-V-E-M .org.au. It's equivalent of our North Valley Animal Disaster Group. And finally, Warriors for Wildlife is an organization helping rescue and treat wildlife in the state of Victoria, which is near Melbourne. And that is Warriors for, the number four, warriorsforwildlife.org. And you can donate online to any of those groups to help them with their wildlife rescue and rehabilitation work. Certainly there's plenty of other groups that are helping the people. I just wanted to shine a little light on those helping the non-humans. In the calendar of events, I just want to put on your calendar February 1st, Sacktown Veg Fest. The fifth annual Sacktown Veg Fest is being held on Saturday, February 1, at the McClellan Conference Center in Sacramento. It is a celebration of vegan, plant-based living featuring vendors, cooking demos, and speakers, and is organized by the Sacramento Vegetarian Society. For more information and for tickets, go to their website at sacktownvegfest.org. And as always, we have one last piece of business to close out today's show, and that is the Animal Rights Quote of the Week. Our quote of the week is from the poet and vegan activist Gretchen Primack, who wrote, "Humans will always live with contradiction, but we can certainly try to minimize it. One way to do so, simply, is to go vegan. It is actually easier to do that than to wrestle with the deep hypocrisy detailed so well so often. There's real joy and peace, not to mention deliciousness and environmental respect in the process." Show notes and links to the articles mentioned in today's show will be posted to the Non-Human Radio Facebook page and on Instagram at Chico Vegan. This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, its underwriters, or its staff. We do, however, reflect the opinions of our non-human fellow earthlings who would rather not be killed and eaten, milked, farmed, hunted, raised, or experimented upon, or otherwise abused. Our theme music is Ready to Fall by vegan activists, rockers, Rise Against. Thank you for listening. This is Jeannie Trezino signing off. If you're interested in being a kinder, more compassionate person in 2020, I encourage you to go to the 10weekstovegan.com website and get started. There's no time like the present.